Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 29. I'm your host, Michael Shoebridge, Director of Strategic Analysis Australia, and I'm joined by my close colleague and friend, Dr. Marcus Hellyer, SAA's very senior head of senior important research. Marcus, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Michael. Here we are, sitting in the heart of the free world, Washington, D.C. We've been called over to the Australian Embassy. Ambassador Rudd needed our services, so we're helping him with a couple of things. First one is a bit of sanitization of his social media.
Hygiene is so important in this world, and you can find, you know, some of the statements I made when I was a young man, if they were on social media now, I might regret.
I think you would. Yeah.
Speaking with Ambassador Rudd, he feels regret about some of his past statements, and just a good bit of cyber hygiene, just cleaning all that up. Yep. Or as you said to him, I can make this go away for you.
So first task, we're nearly done there. There is kind of a long record there, so it's taking a while to go through it. Other task is a bit of career counselling, sort of, you know, a bit of life coaching, helping him think through where he really wants to be.
Opportunities.
Is this the right job for him?
Is it the right fit at the right time?
There are so many opportunities beckoning out there. He's over in the US. Why not just stay over there, become head of the UN?
Could be his calling. Fallback World Health Organization. Tedros character, I think, you know, showed us he shouldn't be in that job with COVID. He still shouldn't be in that job. Maybe Robert F. Kennedy can help get Kevin Rudd the inside running on that one.
The good thing about Kevin is he's always up for a challenge. He's never seen anything that he thought was too big for him.
Well, look, I think there's an air of calmness, focus and purpose here in the embassy, and I'd like to congratulate people on that.
All right. Well, busy agenda.
Well, we've got about five things. We can't not talk about the US election outcome. We'll try and keep it brief. Talk about the strategic review as the core theological text that's now spawned volumes of subsidiary text, with one of them that we'll focus on, the new 2024 Defence Workforce Plan. Just I'll let you know, this is an example of evolution and a deep commitment to continuous transformation in an integrated, focused way for those
evolutionary transformation. Good.
Yes. And then probably a short reading from Senate estimates that not enough listeners really have the opportunity to hear the Parliament doing some of its best work, and defence officials showing why they paid the big bucks. And then you were at the Submarine Institute of Australia meeting, and there's some
picked
wonderful
up a few interesting
there.
Things there.
So Trump, you might think, look, having Donald Trump elected for a second term, this has shaken up some real assumptions about how a lot of Australians think that America works, about Americans themselves, and maybe about what the future of America and maybe the alliance would hold. Do you think there's any thinking going on here in Canberra about what changes might need to make around defence policy in the alliance given this result?
No, none whatsoever.
Trump hasn't changed anything.
I don't think it'll change anything. I mean, we've already seen the Prime Minister approach Mr. Trump and say, stay on board with AUKUS. So if we cast our minds back, Michael, roughly 5-6 years ago when Donald Trump was president the first time around, we had this little burst of thinking in the broader strategic policy community here in Canberra about a plan B for the alliance. So not necessarily abandoning the alliance, but slightly different direction maybe, a rebalancing of reliance versus self-reliance.
Yeah, the term self-reliance was coming back in vogue, wasn't it? Rather than we just buy everything out of the American catalogue and all the way with insert US President X here.
Yeah, that went nowhere. It sort of flourished for a few months and then has gone nowhere. Actually, where we have gone is we have doubled down on the alliance. We have redoubled our commitment to the alliance and essentially our dependence on US technology, whether that's US technology we own or will call upon in time of crisis.
Well, you're right. In fact, we haven't...
AUKUS is the embodiment of that.
Instead of a plan B, we've gone for a plan A squared.
Or A double plus.
A double plus, good. Well, if plan A was good, this is going to be even better.
So I don't see the Donald returning to the presidency fundamentally changing any thinking here in Canberra, which to me I think is a bit of a problem, because here's the problem. The Donald sees alliances as a a total net imbuggerance.
Really?
He doesn't see them as a benefit. He sees them as a cost. He sees the US subsidizing alliances. So all of the US's alliance partners will, I think, have to lift their game.
Ooh.
The problem is you can never know how much is enough. So let's say you increase defense spending from 2 to 2.5 or to 3%. Is that enough to win and keep the Donald's affections? You can never know.
I think it's a bit like parenting. I always think with parenting, you're only as good as what you're doing next. Whatever you have done for your children up to this point is irrelevant. It's just what you do next. The Donald is like that. So if you go to him and say, hey, I'm spending 3% of my GDP on defense, he's not going to say, well done, that makes me so happy. He's going to say, I want 3.5. Or something, there's a new demand. Because the deal doesn't endure. The deal is a moment in time. And then the next moment in time, a new deal can be demanded. I think that's the problem. I've heard you say something like, we can't know Trump and his administration's terms or their demands. And even when we get them, they will not be final.
No. On the good side, though, we are doing everything to show our love for the US. I was recently going through the top 30 projects in the portfolio budget statements. And basically, people have been, particularly in the Australian defence industry, saying, there's all this money, where's it going? Because it's not coming to us.
Ooh.
Well, if you rank the top 30 projects, the US and handing money over to the US figures pretty heavily. So number one, SSN program, $2.2 billion. Well, that's pretty much all going to the US.
And we've
some
only
to the
just
UK.
Begun.
Hunter is next. Well, UK, but a lot of the subsystems are US.
Well, the Aegis part of it,
yes,
US.
US
so
missiles.
Pouring off.
Number three, maritime guided weapons and explosive ordnance. Well, most of that is US missiles.
That's all US catalogue with a little bit of Kongsberg.
Yeah, then we have Boxer CRV, number four. Then five is Black Hawk. Six is Redback, which is Korea. Mm-hmm. But then seven, Armored Combat, which is M1 tanks.
Yep.
Eight, Aegis Baseline, which is essentially upgrade to the US combat
for
system.
For the Hobarts.
On
not,
the Hobarts.
Not the Hunters, yeah.
Then we have MH-60R Seahawk, off-the-shelf US purchase. Then there's Arafura OPV, not
can't
US, but then
that.
Number 11, Air Launch Multi-Domain Strike, bunch of US missiles. 12, F-35A. 13, Growler. 14, Apache. 15 is Triton. 16, Communication Security Modernization. I have no idea what that is, but it does sound a bit like US encryption.
It'll be US crypto gear.
Yeah. Number 17, Poseidon, the P-8. So, you know, we are showing our love to the US.
This is why I find Paul Keating's line about with the nuclear submarines, Australia is giving up our sovereignty to America.
Yeah.
So laughable.
Good luck.
Because
went a long time ago.
That list of the top 30 projects is the people that'll make happiest are the shareholders of the big US defense companies. And you're right. In Trump world, that's a contribution of the large trade deficit that Australia runs with the US, mm-hmm. which in Trump world is all good news. We need to celebrate this massive spend on the US military. And I'm sure that's part of the strategy. It's something that the folk here at the embassy are quite interested in.
So when you take that shopping list and then you refer to the concept of self-reliance, which sort of has come and gone, it's had periods of flourishing, generally under Labor governments, but under this Labor government, it is completely missing in action. It's barely used in the national defence strategy.
Ooh.
And it's not really used in the sense of, well, we need a self-reliant defence capability. There are certain things we need to be able to do. Gone completely. So that's why I say I don't think the return of the Donald will have any effect on Australian defence policy because we are so wedded to the US already.
That was true before Trump was elected for his first term, and we have just gone further and further into that cave since that time. In fact, we're so far into the cave of US dependency and defence, we can't even see daylight from the cave opening anymore.
No, and you hear it when senior defence officials speak. They can't imagine what a self-reliant Australian defence policy would look like. The number of times you hear the term, we will never fight alone, i.e. we will always be this little add-on to the US.
Well, that probably brings us to the main theological text of the Albanese government on defence, which of course it's been given iconic status inside the halls of Russell offices. I don't know whether there are formal readings of it at various meetings, but there are recitals of it now in an enormous production of subsidiary texts.
And what is that canonic text, Michael?
Well, at this point, I must say this is only at this point in mid-November 2024.
What is the source, the font of all wisdom from which this other wisdom flows?
Well, the Strategic Review and then, of course, the National Defence Strategy. One is the Old Testament, one is the New Testament. But together they form the highest theological text inside the defence organisation. And that you'll know that is about an integrated focus force with a generational investment in Australian defence where everything is integrated and focused involving hard decisions, and it's about enhanced lethality in a very self-reliant way that's full of sovereign capability.
Well, or not very self-reliant. So we have these two great testaments of revealed wisdom, and they have spawned a lot of exegesis since then, a lot of interpretation. People are taking this wisdom and turning it into laws, into instructions on how to live. How many sub-texts, by your count, are we up to?
I'm up to 12 at 12. This point. And that is a total of 814 pages. Now, I'd note many of these have classified reviews. These are only the public documents. Mm-hmm. And in my experience, the classified review is roughly twice as long as the unclassified public version. So there's
maybe 814 words.
Pages. Yeah, that means 2,400 pages.
Which no doubt everybody guidance. In defence is reading and committing to memory.
Well, this is an essential part of being a defence professional to have read all of these. Do you want me to just give you the list just quickly, or is it going to be exhausting?
My ears might start bleeding.
I'll try and do it like the Melbourne Cup reading, so I'll be fast. Defence Strategic Review, 112 pages. National Defence Strategy, 76 pages. Integrated Investment Programme, so that's an extra one, up to 1,300 pages. Hillarides Review of Surface Combatants, 24 pages, 5 fact sheets. Workforce Plan, 36 pages, 2 fact sheets. Guided Weapons Plan, 76 pages. Defence Science and Technology Plan, accelerating more, faster, together, delivering later, 60 pages, and 20 pages of science and technology priorities, 2 pages of a DST overview, 2-page fact sheet. The Australian Submarine Agency Plan, 32 pages. Defence Industry Development Strategy, 114 pages, plus about 68 pages of assorted industry priorities and fact sheets.
Is there a fact sheet on the number of fact sheets?
I could produce this as a fact sheet about the fact sheets. The Defence Net Zero Strategy, released with very little fanfare.
What? Sorry, I must have missed that one.
Yep.
When did that come out?
25th of October, 38 pages.
Okay, missed that one.
Defence Future Energy Strategy, released on the same day.
Oh, I missed that one as
25
well.
Pages. One of my personal favourites, if anyone wants to see a low point in government writing and impenetrable gibberish and nonsense, the Defence Culture Strategy and Defence Cultural Blueprint released.
When did that come out? Last year, yep. I missed that one as well.
22 pages. And then a missing review, I don't know how many pages this is, the review of ADF reserves, which will add pages. So it's roughly 8 times the volume of Orwell's Animal Farm.
Okay. All right. Well, the latest one. So, unfortunately, I missed a few of them, but I did see the one that just came out.
The Defence Workforce Plan.
The Defence Workforce
Plan. 2024.
Yes. So, I have actually read it. It's relatively short. Now,
what I liked about it was the beige. It's got a beige cover and back sheet.
Uh-huh.
And to me, that set the right tone. This is indeed a very beige document.
Look, I would have to echo that because, in a sense, it's not really saying aim high. Well, it is sort of aiming high in some ways, aiming low in other ways. So it has reviewed the ADF numbers. Reviewed them down.
Hang on. I thought if you reviewed the ADF numbers, you'd find that the ADF was thousands of people short on the planned growth it's meant to have had over 8 years. You'd need to find a way to really catch up fast. But are you telling me they've reduced their future targets?
We have revised the target down. So it's come down by about 4,700 this year.
Which is remarkably similar to the number they failed to recruit over the last 8 years that they were meant to recruit, isn't
it? Right, yes. Right. So next year, the target's been revised down by a bit over 5,000. In 26-27, the target's been revised down by about 4,500. And then in 27-28, it's been revised down by about 3,600. So the target's been revised down in the short term, Michael, but the good news is that the long-term target still stands.
Right, so we've been failure for the last 8 years. So the next few years' targets, instead of being increased, have been reduced.
Well, I prefer the term accept reality.
The intent to get to this originally stated growth remains.
Yes, we're just shifting it out a little.
Ooh. So I was reading something about what that means for recruitment numbers coming in and about retention of people who are already in, because both these things are key, apparently.
Yes, so you need to bring more people in and you need to keep the ones you've got longer.
So even to meet these reduced targets now?
Well, I think to get to the ultimate target. So we were meant to get to 69,000 by the early 2030s. Well, sorry, we're meant to get there by 2030. We've sort of shifted that out a little to the early 2030s. So that target's moved.
A little bit of beiging up of the target.
And the overall numbers for the ADF at some point, maybe around about 2040, are meant to get to about 80,000. So at the moment, we're about 58,000. We need to get to 80,000. So we need roughly 30-35% growth.
Ooh.
So the trick to getting there, as you noticed, is we need to get more people in and then we need to hang on to them.
It's a lot
longer.
More people, though, isn't it? Because I'm looking at a reading from page 10, paragraph 2.6 of the Defence Workforce Plan.
Of this latest piece of scripture.
Yes, of this subsidiary.
Yes. So we need to increase the inflow from approximately 5,500 per annum to 9,000. So using my little back of the fag packet calculator, that's 64% growth. So we actually need to increase the inflow by 64%. And we also need to hang on to those people a lot longer. So we need to hang on to them. The median length of service must increase from around 7 years to around 12 years. So that's a 71% increase.
So 65% increase in the number of people that are being recruited into the place. And what was that percentage there?
71%.
71% increase in the median service length. And I read on this same page that this is realistic growth that is achievable.
Mm.
But I don't think either of those words are an accurate description for this plan and these targets. Because I look at the average length of service in comparable militaries like the US and UK.
And what you're saying, it is not 12 years.
No. In fact, you're lucky if you get 5 years out of people in the US military. You're lucky if you get 6 years out of people in the UK military. You get down to about 15% of people staying for 10 or 12 years in the US and UK militaries. Now,
But are they getting paid $50,000 to sign on for another term?
Well, I mean, this amongst the nonsense in this workforce plan and its assertions of
strong words, Michael,
of continued transformation. When I see continue close with transformation, I think one of these words can't be true.
Right, there is no structural transformation.
There is no structural transformation. There's an assertion of transformation, but really it's the word that matters in all these documents, all these 814 pages worth of government gibberish that the Defence Organisation has spewed out over the last 2 years. Is continue. They're just continuing with what they've done before.
Yeah, when I look at this workforce model, it replicates what we've seen in the IIP, we see again and again, and that is a small, exquisitely equipped, exquisitely trained ADF with no depth. It can't be rapidly grown. It can't be rapidly mobilized in time of war. It is this small, perfectly crafted ADF, and we've matched perfectly the workforce to the platforms. But of course, we're going to run short of both on day one of the war. And so there's really no different thinking here about a different model of how do you develop a model, a workforce, an ADF that you can grow rapidly? How do you change the kinds of things you buy? How do you change the skills you need to operate that workforce? It is still small numbers of exquisitely trained people. And of course, you can't grow that rapidly. It takes years to develop those skills.
But that is the plan. So all this stuff about how the world's changed and we've got to do things urgently and we've lost 10 years warning time, these 814 pages are all on the 2040 timeframe. So look at the workforce plan and look at these Monet pastel sketches of workforce demand for the three services. They've got little shaded boxes between now and 2040 predicting their exquisite demand for workforce for various platforms. And all they tell you is defence's plan is all about some distant future in the 2040s, and they're trying to predict the demographics and requirements they'll have for them then. So surface combatants, well, apparently they're in no trouble at the moment. The workforce can meet requirements, which can only be because most of the fleet is tied up, fragile, not yet in service like the supply ships, or about to go into upgrades for years like the Hobart. But then there are some minor stresses from 2028, and then there are some big workforce pressures from 2032, which of course is when the Hunters start rolling off.
But they're not actually resolved.
No.
They stay bad all throughout the 2030s.
Workforce pressure is then sustained ad infinitum for the Navy's surface fleet. And it's the same across the board. Although the good news is, on their unmanned undersea workforce, they see some minor demands between now and 2030. And after that, it's a doddle, job done.
So what you're saying is, even though we've got this new workforce plan, it doesn't actually, in Defence's own assessment, resolve the Navy's workforce crisis in submarines and surface combatants.
No,
it's two core lines of warfighting.
It just tells us the trouble is going to get much worse. And the Air Force one is really interesting. It's in sky blue and various pastel shades of sky blue. And it just tells us they've got emerging pressures across the board.
So it doesn't actually seem to be a great plan if it doesn't actually resolve the workforce problems. And to the extent it does resolve them, it's based upon some rather ambitious thinking around achievable inflows and achievable retention.
Well, despite the words, it is not realistic and it is not achievable. All they've done is kick the ball down the road, where they say they won't have remediated, which is even matching inflows to outflows, until sometime around 2026. So it's bought the senior leadership some more time to say they're still looking for green shoots of change.
Mm. Now, speaking of kicking the ball down the road, that gets us to a project, JP9102, which was meant to be secure satellite communications.
We were getting a constellation, weren't we? That Australia was going to own
We're still getting a constellation, apparently. It's just not clear how we're going to get it. So the government and defence have been very clear, Michael, very clear that we have not cancelled the project.
Crystal clear. They're not stargazing on this.
We have not cancelled the project. All canceled. We have done is we have cancelled the ongoing tender process that was actually going to identify what and how we were going to deliver.
Look, Marcus,
a solution.
You can try and verbal defence officials as much as you like, but on this occasion, I think we've got to let the officials' words speak for themselves. And we also need to really up the public's interest in watching Senate estimates and seeing
it's
our Parliament
must
in
watch TV, Michael.
So this is the moment to do a short reading, because this is a theological episode.
Okay, we're doing a reading. It's my big moment in theatre.
I'll play someone who I am vaguely related to, somebody called Senator Shoebridge, and you can be various defence officials.
Do you know him?
I've met him.
You've met him? Okay.
You can be various defence officials.
I'll be various defence officials, yes.
But I think I'll outrank you. I'm a senator. You're only a lieutenant general.
Excuse me.
Or an air marshal.
Excuse me, I have 3 stars.
In space, that might mean something. Let's get into this. So this is page 62 from Wednesday last week, 6th November.
Okay.
Senator Shoebridge, could I just go back to the satellite? This is a micro US subs disaster, isn't it? Do I have the time frame right? The decision was made to acquire the satellite in 2021. Is that when it started, Secretary? Is that when the first decision was made? If you can't answer, maybe someone who's more familiar with it can answer.
I'm generic official. The government's first pass approval was in June 2020. Defence went to tender for a defence-owned and operated geostationary Earth orbit satellite communication system in April 2021. Lockheed Martin Australia was announced as the preferred tenderer in April 2023. On 4 November, Defence advised it had decided to cease its current procurement activity with Lockheed Martin for a single Earth orbit geostationary satellite communication system.
So in June 2020, it was a great idea, and by 4th November 2024, it was a terrible idea that should be junked. Is there any reflection on how Defence made such a strategic error in June 2020?
I wouldn't describe it as a terrible judgment to make a change.
I said strategic error in 2020.
It's more that there was a change in circumstances and threat at the time, which afforded us the opportunity to review what we were providing as our capability and what we assessed that we would need going forward sooner.
But you confirmed that part of the enhanced space capabilities would be the delivery of sovereign-controlled Australian defence satellite communications as recently as in the Integrated Investment Program. You put $9 billion to $12 billion in for the project. So was it still the right idea at the time of the Integrated Investment Program?
Yes, but there was a change in language. The Integrated Investment Program uses the term sovereign control, which means that we have assured access to space services.
So this is redefining sovereign. It went from being sovereign to now sovereign control. So it's owned by someone else, but we may have a contract?
As my colleague said, when we first went to market, we went with the view it would be sovereign owned and operated.
So now it will be someone else's and we may have a contract?
It may potentially be. We are yet to go through the process of understanding what future options might look like. It will be assured satellite services for the Australian Defence Force.
Any poor small to medium enterprise that was investing in this in Australia, thinking that actually there was still something of substance here, should have, I don't know, read the tea leaves and realised that by going from sovereign owned to sovereign controlled, you were cancelling a $7 billion project. They should have read the tea leaves, should they?
No. Defence acknowledged the cessation of this procurement activity and the impact that it may have on defence industry in Australia, particularly for SMEs, as was described by my colleague. We will remain engaged with industry during the development of our future capability options, and options will exist for defence industry involvement going forward. It would be preemptive to determine just how much and to whom at this point in time.
But you knew something was on when you put the Integrated Investment Program out because you changed the language. You must have known this was likely to be cancelled. You just told nobody. Australian companies continued to invest and put their money and resources in on the assumption that there was still something of substance here. You must have known something was happening when you put out the Integrated Investment Program. Otherwise, why change the language?
The approach to every capability decision defence makes and proposes to the government is to go through the capability that exists on the market and prepare wholesome advice to the government that addresses all those components.
I hope all the advice is wholesome, but is it accurate and timely? So a program that began in June 2020 has cost $90 million and so far got zero satellites and will be rescoped over the next year to start again in 2025. You're going to restart the planning in 2025. So we'll be 5 years down the track and $90 million in the hole with no satellites and no additional capacity. So what's going to happen in 2025?
The delivery of that satellite system under the current RFT would not have been delivered until the early 2030s. We are not going to have a satellite in the short term. We'll work with our allies, partners and industry next year to provide options to government for their consideration for an accelerated pathway to achieve the same timeline, if not earlier.
So by 2025, after 5 years of work and $90 million of sunk costs, sometime next year, we'll have options for an accelerated pathway. Will options for an accelerated pathway keep us safe? And there ends the reading.
Maybe we will end the reading there. But yeah, here we go. After 5 years of work, we will have started to reconsider our options.
I tell you what, having these officials sit there and say after 5 years and $90 million of wasted money and cancelling a program they've been planning for years, they're accelerating delivery is shameless.
I do not think this word means what you think it means.
Well, I'm going to put a link in to George Orwell's Politics and the English Language because he says in that, in our time, political speech and writing, and I would include official speech now, are largely the defence of the indefensible. Thus, political language has to consist largely of euphemism, question begging, and sheer cloudy vagueness. The great enemy of clear language is insincerity. Where there's a gap between one's real and one's declared aims, one turns, as it were, instinctively to long words and exhausted idioms. That is what we heard from defence officials at Senate Estimates in that reading. That is what you read in this over 800 pages of collected publication.
Mm-hmm. And putting a word in for Australian industry here, the other thing we learned here is that $90 million that has been spent, that was all sort of spent on by defence on defence's own costs. Apparently Lockheed Martin doesn't have a contract with defence, so they haven't been getting paid for the work they've been putting in for the last 4 years. And Lockheed Martin's local Australian Australian partners, little Aussie SMEs, weren't getting paid by Lockheed Martin.
So they've been led on for 5 years now. Meanwhile, $90 million has been spent by defence, but not on anything that's actually resulted in any capability.
So once again, Aussie industry is out of pocket. They've done this all at risk. And it's not just Australian companies. So we saw this with Naval, the French submarine company. We've seen it with Larsen have packed up shop and left, the OPV builders, because they've been burned so badly. So whether you're big or small, you just keep getting burned by defence here.
Well, there's a line from Moriarty, isn't there? Secretary Moriarty, about this.
Well, yes, he was asked about this by the senators, saying, well, this isn't great for Australia's reputation, and industry partners might reconsider and say that think there's too much sovereign risk about working with the Australian Defence Department. But Mr. Moriarty did answer this, and he said, well, because the defence budget is doubling over the next decade, it's not actually in real terms. Put no. that aside. His view was is that actually industry partners will be lining up to get a share of that action. I don't know, because what I'm seeing on the ground here in Australia is companies are actually leaving the defence market.
Well, it's that complacent, high-handed, contemptuous attitude to industry. You know, you've got nowhere to go. You need the money I will give you, so you'll always be there. I think that is a ticking time bomb of a problem for the defence organisation and whoever are the unfortunate ministers that will be presiding.
I do think it is very contemptuous of defence industry to say, well, we've got money, so they're going to come begging.
Yeah. Well, look, this brings us obviously to the Submarine Institute of Australia annual meeting. We've got money, so they're going to come begging. The amount of money that's already started to pour off into submarine land, probably what Secretary Moriarty was referring to. So you were there. I didn't have the pleasure of attending.
I did get to go for a couple of
what
days.
What did you learn?
Did I learn a lot?
Did you hear from the Chief of Navy a spirited defence of how well things are going?
I did learn from Chief of Navy that things are much better than the media described. So the media had put out a story recently saying that only one submarine was available.
And he was there to tell you that is not true.
He basically put the media back in their place.
Did he say that wasn't true? There's more than one submarine available?
What he did say is that the media are very quick to criticise, but when there's good news, they don't report good news. Recently at one point, there were four submarines at sea, and the media didn't report
that. Why didn't they report that?
One view is that they're just mean and snarky. Mm. The other view is that no one tells them. So a little after the Chief of Navy spoke and bashed up the media for not reporting the good news about submarine availability, one of his officers, so a senior submariner, gave a presentation. And the media said, well, okay, so how many submarines generally do you have available? Can you actually give us some information on general rates of submarine availability?
So the good news could be reported.
Unfortunately, for security reasons, Defence can't tell the media that.
He wouldn't say.
No, wouldn't say. So I'm still struggling a bit to understand how the media can get the good news out if defence won't tell them. But apparently you can still bash the media up for not putting the good news out that you won't tell them.
Defence won't give them, yes. But he did seem to accept that, yes, now there's only one available Collins-class submarine, but he told us that was actually good news and the media were mistaken about that too, weren't they? Because one submarine is the government's requirement. The Navy's meeting the government's requirement.
Don't verbal him. He did say defence is meeting the government's requirements. So if we cast our minds back to the Cole review that sort of put submarine sustainment on the path to goodness, the contract in that is out of six submarines, so two will be in deep maintenance, four will be available to the Chief of Navy, and two will be deployable. So really, and that's WorldSpec's best practice. So what I think is actually the kind of dirty secret here is not that sometimes you have one or none available, but success is two deployable. That is success under the current model. Yep. And the Chief of Navy said, we are meeting the government's requirements for submarine capability.
Yeah, but if you zoom back a little bit, there's the point about when he says the government's requirements, he means the technical definition of availability that defence offers up to the government and says, here's what we can do, so this is your requirement. They say, yes, that's right. How did you know?
Yes.
So you're always going to meet the requirement because you give them the requirement.
But it is a completely circular definition. So
if you get away from that self-licking ice cream and think, well, hang on, wasn't it 2009 that then Prime Minister Rudd, in a previous incarnation, incarnation, said actually Australia doesn't have enough submarines, we need 12 submarines.
Yes. So back in 2009, Prime Minister Rudd said the world is getting more dangerous, we need more submarine capability. Every successive Australian government has agreed with both of those propositions. The world is getting more dangerous and we need more submarine capability. They may have changed the submarine solution, but they have agreed with those proposals. And in fact, just every time you see a piece of exegesis, theological exegesis come out of the Defence Department, it says the world has gotten even more dangerous since the last time we spoke to you, but we still have the same level of submarine capability that we had in 2009.
Well, no, we don't. We've got a lesser submarine capability because the Collins have got older.
Well, they're 15
more
years older.
They're not delivering the same available numbers or deployable numbers. So 2009 to now, that's 15 years.
We have no more submarines.
It now is giving the government less than governments have said routinely, consistently, that they've wanted ever since 2009.
Yes, by definition, the Collins fleet cannot give you the submarine capability we need because we have said repeatedly we need more submarine capability. All the Collins fleet can give you is what is actually able to give you. It is a completely circular definition.
And that is shrinking, by the way. There was another great thing. I wasn't there. I really wish I had because I would have loved to have heard this from his mouth. But the Chief of Navy is reported to have said that he is the first head of Australia's nuclear navy.
He did say that, yes. Well, we have nuclear-trained submariners now, Michael. They've graduated from the US and UK submarine training establishments. What's your point?
My point is this is pompous and delusional and brings him into disrepute.
What do you really think?
It's a decade from now, best case, that a Chief of Navy, an Australian Chief Navy, will be able to say, I've got one nuclear submarine. For the current Chief of Navy to declare himself Australia's first Chief of a nuclear navy.
Just because we don't have a nuclear submarine, Michael.
It's beyond absurd. And it probably, I was looking at this other document, I didn't include this in the 814 pages. The workplace experience of the Navy in April this year.
So there's a workforce survey.
Yeah. And the service, well, there's one service with a worse and faster collapsing perception of its senior leadership, which is the Army. But the Navy, people in the Navy have an increasingly poor view of their senior leaders. They see them as less and less effective. In fact, 32% of the Navy, actual people in the Navy, feel that their senior leaders are effective. And that has dropped off since 2020. I'd say it was about 45%, look at this graph, back in 2020. It's now 32%. So
that's a rather precipitous decline.
A third. Okay. And you'd have to say, with this delusional rhetoric out of people like the Chief of Navy, this could be why.
Mm-hmm. You asked me what I learned at the SIA. I can say what I didn't learn, and that I'm still struggling around this issue of why SSNs in the first place, other than that they are better than conventional submarines. So there were a lot of presentations that talked about the need for submarines. And in fact, ComSubPac, the head of the US Navy's Pacific Submarine Force, actually quoted Kim Beazley to say why we needed submarines. And apparently Mr. Beazley said, no, without submarines, there is no deterrence. But I'm still really struggling to kind of quite understand who we are trying to deter. And what are we trying to deter them from doing?
So Australian officials refer to US Navy people about how essential submarines are for deterrence. US Navy officials then refer to former Australian ministers for defence about why submarines are essential. And then the whole perfect virtuous circle goes round again.
Well, I suspect the US Admiral was doing this to sort of suggest that the US wasn't trying to shove submarines down our throat.
No, we're doing that ourselves.
So, so I still haven't quite gotten my head around that completely. There's this bit of sleight of hand in the logic always occurs. So there's this discussion about Australia's maritime trading nation. We're dependent on sea lanes of communication. Jump a few, you know, several links along the chain of logic. Ergo, we need SSNs without really any discussion of how submarines protect sea lanes of communication.
But it's part of an integrated focus force. So for example, isn't it true, I think you were mentioning this to me, that the US Navy has lost more ships to mines than submarines or any other form of weaponry.
Yes, which would suggest we should we should invest heavily in our mine countermeasure fleet. Unfortunately, that's not the case. We're sort of deep into the process of abolishing it completely, as far as I can see.
Yeah, the six mine hunters, we're now down to two.
I think we're down to two, yeah. With no real replacement in the IIP.
Yeah.
But to get back to the argument for SSNs, there's sort of this vague association with sea lanes of communication. But then we jump over here to the work of theology, the DSR and the NDS, which says our national defense strategy is a strategy of deterrence by denial. And then we start doing maps of here's submarines defending our northern approaches.
Ooh.
Without any real discussion of why SSNs and why couldn't you do that with, say, conventional submarines or B-21s or mines?
And how do you protect your sea lanes if your enemy mines them with cheap volume mines?
So yeah. I'm still struggling with the actual need in the first place.
Well, look, I think you've
I'm
just
got
to accept.
I'm willing to be convinced, but I haven't heard
theology is about faith. So you need to accept that eight nuclear submarines, getting them between now and 2054, is what Australia needs. It's the answer, and you need to stop looking for the question.
Well, I did hear from a number of the senior speakers. There were ambassadors, there were high commissioners, there were senior defence people, and they did, again, lecture the media, saying it's the responsibility of media to make the case to the Australian public for why we need SSNs, which I'd be happy to do. I just haven't quite heard the case from defence in compelling terms.
Well, look, we're out of time, but I think there's one other really great short statement that we need that I understand Deputy Prime Minister Richard Mulls, who is also still the Defence Minister, I think, gave in a rousing call to people at the conference.
I did learn something. I have learned that scrutiny is actually a good thing. And here are the Deputy Prime Minister's words. There needs to be a holding to account of government, of people sitting in this chair.
Mm.
So a chair actually at a hotel in Canberra.
But he was in the chair.
Yeah, he was in the chair. Ooh. I think he meant the chair that whatever chair he's sitting in.
His chair.
Yeah, his chair needs to be held to account constantly.
Ooh.
This needs to be done with intelligence clearly. But please bring that intelligence to the table. But there is. It's such a big thing to do that, you know, we need to know where balls have been dropped, where cracks are opening up. We need to know so that we're doing everything we can to pick them up again, to fill those cracks, to make sure that we can keep this thing on track. We are not going to get through this without intense scrutiny. So give it to us. Like, I genuinely mean that. With intelligence, but give it to us.
Marcus, we'll end here. I just can't help saying how refreshing it is to hear Deputy Prime Minister Miles recognise he needs to pick up his balls and fill his cracks. It's a wonderful example, and I can't say it better than he said himself.
Well,
wonderful.
We'll see you next time.